Birmingham Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport podcast. Hello and welcome to Verulam Sport on 92.6 FM, where every Saturday, the team behind the award-winning Verulam Sports will provide you with in-depth analysis based on your choices of sporting topics. Really excited for this week's one, but always, before we drill into it, a thank you for those who have engaged with us, and a reminder to keep involved, keep engaged. This is your show, every single bit as much as it is ours. So continue to tweet us at Verulam Sport and keep involved. But now we are going to get underway because I can't believe where the year's flying by. We're in August. How's that happened? And it's a surreal year. I think everybody would agree that's the case for the year of our Lord 2020. And it should have been already the European Championships, of course. Due to the global situation, they have been postponed. They were scheduled to already been finished June the 12th to July the 12th. 2020 was the original scheduled format for this, but it's been shifted across to 2021. So the debate that we're going to launch, and this again is based on your suggestions, so thank you again. The debate's this: is that year going to prove beneficial for the England Three Lions, Southgate's men, or were they primed, ready and raring to go, and therefore maybe it's a bit of a disadvantage? Always keen to have your views. I know you're awash with opinions. Keep them coming. Tweet at Verulam Sports. But just before we get the top lines and hear what people's opinions on this are from the world of social media, firstly, it's befitting for me now to introduce the man, the bona fide legend, which is our very own machine, Jason McKenna. How you doing, Jace?
A little bit hot at the moment. I think my bedroom represents probably a Bauhaus kind of museum to fans. If somebody kind of watched it, they'd think, oh, this is some sort of weird art exhibition. August has not been very good in terms of office work, but my goodness, I'm enjoying the sun. And I think we will have a heated debate as well, because I think Euro 2021 is going to be a very interesting one. And it certainly has been with our listeners as well. People have been getting involved, as you said there, Tony. People have been sending in their opinions on it. And John has been very damning of the England team, of the Three Lions. He said, England aren't going to win anyway, so we're just prolonging the pain. So waiting 1 year on, I think John is quite negative there, and maybe we'll get onto that. But Susie has said it's partially a home tournament, so it is coming home, and anything can happen. I think that's true. In front of a home audience, they can really rouse the players. And then Michael said, maybe we won't win, but I think we will get far. And I think it's a sentiment that I share as well there, Tony. But what do you think about those initial social media messages? Is John a bit too harsh? Is Susie a bit too forward-thinking? And is Michael a bit too hopeful?
I love the fact that right there we've got the eclecticism, isn't it? And it really is going to be one of those. Because quite frankly, one of those three scenarios is going to come to pass, surely. I will say this much. We're going to really get into the nitty-gritty of this. We're going to dissect it from a myriad of angles. For a start off, I want to really just focus in on Gareth Southgate. Because I really admire him. And obviously, I even like the little touches because, Jason, we've spoken about a whole heap of things to do with sports over the years. But one of the key common denominators is sometimes it is these peculiar one percenters, which may be not even tangible. But over time, based on a culture, they do add up. And everybody remembers that waistcoat look of the Gareth Southgate. Very smart, look the part. And I know there's an old one in business. It's almost act as if. I really like that kind of smart attire. And I know that that is something that's very important in terms of how England dress, act, et cetera, et cetera. He's a class act. I got a lot of respect for Gareth Southgate. And that will come up in different forms throughout this conversation. However, I got to say, frankly, my own perspective is it's just been so long with so much hurt that I still can't begin even to allow myself to get overly optimistic. I suspect we will be competitive. I think it was an amazing shout because one of the participants there on social media, do keep involved, tweet at Barrow Sport, keep involved, love your views. About the home field aspect, all of England's matches are going to be at Wembley, so that's advantageous. Obviously, everybody can remember the summer of 1996, and of course, that glorious World Cup from 66 on home turf. The semi-final and the final, of course, will also be at Wembley. So, football will be coming home next summer. No questions about it. Will that coincide with England in glorious form? We're going to analyse that to the nth degree. But yeah, I just think let's, for a moment, when all things are neutral and equal, I will always, Jason, always veer towards my pint is half full. So I'm going to be optimistic, although 50 plus years of hurts. It's hard to really see anything other than maybe another agonising, tantalising failure. Your thoughts on Southgate and that culture, though, that he's created and creating?
I like the shout there that you've kind of given there of waistcoat, good luck and everything. Because, you know, kind of off air, we've discussed, as an Arsenal fan, I've been so happy this week because Arsenal lifted an FA Cup. And I'm not a man, I'm quite a logical, machine-like man. But for FA Cup finals or any kind of final Arsenal are involved in, I kind of go through a procedure and that kind of involves just doing silly things that I feel that are lucky. But there's a real serious kind of thought there. And I know this for certain because I know people that have actually worked with Southgate. He is a psychological man. He is about kind of marginal gains here and there. That's why the penalties worked. He's one of the only managers in English history for some reason that actually worked on penalties. And it's kind of a joke there, you know, the waistcoat, but there's all aspects that Southgate will want to keep fixed, be, in air quotes, lucky for the players. And I think that's going to be a big thing. And I think Southgate is one of these modern managers that he knows about tactics, but he's also looking into the psychology in other areas for the team. And I think we might get onto it a little bit later, but set pieces was one thing that really impressed me that not enough big teams do. And that's where England really got to the semi-final. They did fantastically well off their set pieces.
I love that you referenced that semi-final. Of course, you're referring to the last World Cup where England, again, reached the semi-final. Interesting fact is that Gareth Southgate is only the third English manager to reach a World Cup semi-final. Of course, there's the legendary Sir Alf Ramsey, who remains as present, the only English manager to hold aloft what was then the Jules Rimet Trophy, obviously now the World Cup. We've eulogised massively about Bobby Robson. And if you haven't heard a podcast that we did where we analysed the best sporting movies all time and documentaries, do check that one out for in-depth analysis on the great man, Bobby Robson. So to become only the third English manager to reach a semi-final is very, very impressive. His record as head coach or manager of England, the Three Lions, played 41, won 24, 9 draws, 8 defeats. Thus, a reasonably proud win ratio of 58.5%. So I'm a big fan, as I've already said. I want that very clearly defined for the record. But I'm going to throw this at you, Jason, and maybe your thoughts, because, again, one can only learn. That's the nature of any successful individual, and Southgate fits that category. However, coming back to that referenced semi-final defeat in the last World Cup, where they were beaten by Croatia, Jason, for me, they had that game in the palm of their hand. They scored an early goal. And then, for some reason, which always has to, you know, the book has to stop somewhere, and so I'm throwing this book firmly at Southgate, they went into their shell. They went ultra-defensive. I'm not saying that they should have necessarily gone gung-ho and kind of, you know, just played crazy football, but having played this positive style throughout the tournament, having scored that early goal in the semi-final, then that game surely was theirs for the taking. And ultimately, I'm sure Southgate will have learned lessons from that. But for me, I'm concerned by that because, again, winners win. And winners get a sense of when they are on the cusp of victory. And that has to come from the manager. It has to come from on high. And at the moment, we still haven't yet got, in football, that predatory instinct. And I'm wondering whether Gareth is the man to instill that. Your thoughts on that little bit of analysis?
Yeah, it's a really good point there, Tony. And I mean, we can ask it a little bit later, but do you consider the international league or the European one that kind of happened in the summer, is that considered a semi-final as well? I don't know, but kind of adding to your argument there, it's two semi-final defeats for England in, quote, big tournaments. But yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think what has vexed England for quite a long while since Venables has been a lack of tactics. But I think in the semi-final, arguably, Southgate over-tacticked in there. He kind of over-managed and he regressed a little bit too much in the game. I think also one of the big problems that I have had with Southgate is since that World Cup and also during it as well, there was a lot of chopping and changing. Certain players, certain places weren't cemented. And I don't think that you can win tournaments. You can't win things without a settled first 11. You look at the greatest teams of all time. And a stat for you there, 12 different midfielders have been used in this qualifying campaign since the 2018 World Cup. That's the worry for, you know, many a manager as to settle that England side, and it seems to be a problem for Southgate as well. Pep Guardiola kind of always says, I don't have a plan B, just do plan A better. Sometimes I think, does Southgate even know what his best plan A is? He does do tactics, but I think he's just a little bit worried sometimes about fitting every person in, which is something that a lot of England managers have had over the years.
I think you're dead right there. And I think that's some really wonderful analysis. Again, for me, I'm going to reserve judgment and I want to make it very clear once again that I have so much admiration for Gareth Southgate. You mentioned that inaugural UEFA Nations League. My overall perspective on that is it's very nebulous indeed. I felt that was a bit of almost an attempt to artificially recreate in football the much loved rugby union Six Nations type affair. But nevertheless, England did top a group. They got revenge over Croatia. They got the first victory in Spain, actually, in 31 years in topping their group. And then, as you say, were dispatched by the Dutch. They did go on to claim third place in that 2019 tournament, beating Switzerland on penalties, maybe applying some of that rigour to that aspect of tournament play. They're beating Switzerland on penalties 6-5. But again, my concern would be, it does represent a hurdle short. And as I say, winners win. Maybe the subtext underlying what you've just expressed vis-a-vis Southgate is that he's a very astute man. He has this kind of empathy and also the 360, a diligence into preparation and all the other stuff, which is so strong. But is he, I wonder, just too nice? Is it the case that nice guys will maybe not finish last, but fail to win? Quickly, again, your thoughts psychologically on our head honcho of the Three Lions.
Well, just before we get on to maybe the psychology, I've got one question to maybe ask you on that to maybe seal it. But do you think possibly the fact that England was so unfancied going into the semi-final of the, well, to go into any sort of depth in that World Cup, do you think maybe the success story is that Southgate did what he did with, you know, probably a slapdash squad put together? You know, England weren't fantastic. Ashley Young, 32 years old, was in there. You know, he was kind of one of the prime players. Fabian Delph, kind of a backup to Manchester City. I think, you know, maybe a positive here, and maybe I'm trying to fish for a positive, but England weren't a great team going into that tournament, and maybe artificially Southgate's actually raised expectations for himself.
I think, again, a very, very valid point. I think, weirdly, they actually drew more matches than they actually won in the World Cup. I think it is indeed the case. They actually lost more than they won, bizarrely. So certain things were in their favour, and there wasn't that weight of expectation. But again, then you have to adapt. And you have to sort of, I mean, this is where the greats are great. When they have that carpe diem quality, they seize the day. And seriously, again, getting a goal up over Croatia. I'm not saying that necessarily would have beaten the France in the final. I mean, but then you're 90 minutes away and you've got to believe. My point's very simple. I'm yet to be convinced that Southgate has all the answers. Jason, just before we move on from Southgate, but of course he will play such a critical role in any chances for England 2021 Euros. My concern that you've raised is that, again, this lack of clarity on who is his best 11, as you've addressed such a litany of midfielders, all many of whom similar style. My concern at the moment is he doesn't seem to know who his best goalkeeper is. Pickford, of course, was instrumental in that tournament we've referenced, both in the World Cup and in the UEFA Nations League, where he actually became the first goalkeeper ever for England to both save and score a penalty. Kudos to him. 100 plus Premier League games, 24 caps. However, last season, I know you are the stat man, but his kind of number of goals conceded was very, very high indeed for a wannabe international. Then you've, of course, got Pope, two caps, and Henderson. Where is Henderson going to be next season? Will he be replacing De Gea, or is he going to stay with Stoke? I mean, goodness me, if you want to be an England number one, you need to be number one for your team. But those three are still kind of causing consternation. One thing that is clear, the emblem of any team, you always want competition. I think that's critical. But as you say, you want consistency. And I don't think Southgate has consistency or clarity at this time as to that crucial spine, that centre-back, centre-midfield partnerships, and obviously the goalkeeper. Jason, ending Southgate, I think, now. But I'd like to ask you this, not necessarily the individual components of your England 11, but how would you line them up? What would be your nominal kind of England formation at this time, based on the array of talent that is available?
Yeah, kind of maybe springing upon my point before that, maybe England played negative football up until now because they didn't have the players. But I think now there's no excuse. He should be playing a 4-3-3. He should be going for attacking, beautiful football. And I think that he should be playing on the front foot. He can press. He's got players like Alexander-Arnold, Chilwell, who are really good at that. Yeah. He's got Maguire, who's a very progressive defensive passer. And then in the midfield, there is a litany of talent. You know, you've got Grealish, arguably one of the best creative midfielders in the league. You've got the emerging Phil Foden, James Maddison, top five. I would even throw in there Calvin Phillips as a DM. You know, you're probably more au fait with him than myself, but I think he's been Premier League standard for a long while. And again, maybe a criticism of Southgate is that kind of Premier League top six focus. Sancho, Ings, Sterling should all be in and around there. But for me, maybe one of my big choices of potentially playing lesser role is Harry Kane, because I just don't think he has been as good as the likes of Rashford, Ings, and some of the other forwards for England. But maybe that's a debate for another day. But I think that is one for me. I just think, on your question that you asked me earlier, is Southgate strong enough? Because I think the problem with England managers through yesteryear up until now is the press, the criticism, and you become enemy of the state number one if you make this, in air quotes, wrong choice, when, you know, football is so subjective. And will he be able to live with that? Because we know that he struggled with that penalty miss in 96. Will it be the same all over again? I really hope not. But I don't know, what about yourself there, Tony? Do you think that he's strong enough to make those decisions? And do you think that I'm right that England should be playing 4-3-3, or should we still be playing what I would say is a little bit boring five at the back?
Again, always appreciate your in-depth understanding of the beautiful game.
I'm reserving judgment and erring on the side as I tend to default to positivity. What I'd like to think is, what was very clear, is that Gareth Southgate is a very capable, intelligent player and manager. And as an intelligent person, I would like to think that maybe the lessons of that World Cup, again, they weren't necessarily applied as we've referenced in that UEFA Nations League, but I hope he learns those lessons. And the key word there is positivity. And just think there is the kind of potential within this England team to do real great things. I just hope that whatever happens, they take that belief, learn the lessons, focus in on the journey that has been made, and keep the faith, for want of a better phrase. Just real quickly, the two interesting points you made there. Very rarely do I quibble on certain things, but I just wonder if maybe your particular North London allegiances scurry your view on Harry Kane. I mean, even in an injury-plagued season last season for Spurs, the 27-year-old was the sixth top scorer in the Premier League with 18 goals. He's got 32 England goals, granted a few penalties, but you know my opinion, at the end of the day, it goes in the net, it's a goal. That's the bottom line. But 32 England goals places him sixth all time in England's goal-scoring record, and only 23 off Wayne Rooney. For me, Kane has to feature. I think he's got to have a point to prove next season. I think he's going to be determined to prove to everybody that indeed he was worthy of that golden boot in that last World Cup, that he is indeed the main man. So I'm excited to see Harry Kane next season. For me, just my personal opinion, he is, I don't think critical. I don't think there's a negativity when we place so much hope on just one human being's shoulders. I think you've referenced there are so many talented men who could well step in. However, at this moment in time, he is still an incredibly important part, and I would have him as the fulcrum with two others off him in your attacking style of 4-3-3. I think in this modern age, like we witnessed again in that Croatia game, sorry to circle back to it yet again, but you just simply cannot defend against the world-class, elite-level talent, okay, for 90 minutes. You need to be on the front foot. Always, attack is the best form of defense. So I'd still have Kane as critical. I definitely, though, another name you mentioned, be excited to see where he'll be plying his trade next season. Lots of paper talk, but Jordan Sancho. What a campaign. Tell you what, Jason, 17 goals, 16 assists last year for Borussia Dortmund. The guy's got pace, he's got skills, he's got great vision. I honestly would have him as the first name on my sheet, and I'd work around him. I genuinely think he has that kind of explosive quality. And also, those 16 assists will tell you, unlike a lot of players who maybe play with an ego, for a great young talent, he's got a great footballing IQ. And again, for me, with that kind of explosive quality, I would certainly have him in the 4-3-3 with Kane at the fulcrum of that, and then twinning it and with lots of motion, moving, not fixed, alongside, Sancho as referenced, and the ever-improving Raheem Sterling. So they would be my three at the top. But again, just ever so quickly, Jason, your thoughts on Sancho? Goodness me. He's going to be a Premier League star next campaign.
Well, we'll see if Sancho makes it over to the Premier League. At the moment, you know, we're kind of seeing a big transfer battle that we see in silly season. Dortmund don't necessarily need to sell, but obviously I think that they could do with the money, as a lot of teams could. And I think Man United are probably the likely team. In terms of him, I think you're dead right. He's probably one of the players that has to be starting every week, along with Sterling. In terms of, you know, I think we can move on in a second, but just my reservement on Harry Kane is due to his injuries and his more reserved role. If he played as a false nine, I would be happy to see that, because he scored 18 goals this season, but if you look at his heat map, it's more been a central attacking / central midfielder at times, which isn't good enough. But in terms of those two, Sancho and Sterling, it is scary, I think, for a lot of other international teams. And with that year difference as well, I think that will only serve the betterment of England. I think it's just that midfield really, really needs to be sorted out. And I think that's going to be the big pivotal winner or loser for England next year. They really need to decide who's going to be in the midfield, 3, 4, 5, whatever they're planning to do.
Really well made points. Jason, just circling back, because again, my concerns, as we've addressed, is this lack of clarity, particular to the spine. For you at the moment, is Pickford the man? Again, he's conceded an awful lot of easy goals last year for Everton. I know he's, I guess, the incumbent, but I thought Pope was outstanding once again for Burnley last campaign, and Henderson, featuring for Stoke, was outstanding too. Of those three, who would be your man in the sticks for England?
I want to use the swear word that you don't like, XG, but it's quite a good measure for goalkeepers in terms of the quality. So Dean Henderson, I think he is possibly the best England goalkeeper we've seen emerge for a long while. And I know you kind of charged me with this as well with Trent Alexander-Arnold, that I'm a bit premature, but I'm just looking at kind of data here. And the fact that he prevented 8.3 goals. I know 0.3 of a goal is a bit of a weird thing to fathom, but that's the weird thing about XG. But also 60 shots saved in the box. That's one of the best all season. He is an absolutely fantastic goalkeeper, and he's part of the second best defence in the Premier League in Sheffield United. An absolute stalwart, a machine himself. I think he's the best pick. Pope would be second, and I think both of them, you know, on their day are nearly world-class or are world-class. And I think you said rightly that De Gea is going to have to be looking over his shoulder at Man United, because I think Henderson's better than him now already. I will be interested to see where he plies his trade, if he continues with Sheffield United. But I think he's done well there and he's nailed a place down. Pope is obviously with Burnley. They're two lower downsides. Now, that's a question that you can ask. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're not top five, top six, whereas Pickford is probably more likely to be knocking on the door there. But I think form definitely comes over what team you're playing. And I think previously England have focused too much on, you know, these sorts of names or their names in squads. So for me, Dean Henderson is number one, Pope number two, and I really don't like Pickford. You know, looking at his data through the season, he's made a hell of a lot of mistakes. He's actually let in 5 more goals than he should have all season. I don't think he should be anywhere near that squad. I don't know if I'm too harsh, Tony, because he is a penalty expert, but penalties only get you so far.
Interesting. I think you made, as always, some great points. Although, of course, penalties have been the bane of England in so many tournaments. And again, I did reference he was the first player ever to both score and save a penalty for England. A shot stopper, I think he will be feeling the heat. I really do. It's his to lose, whether that's right or wrong, that is the case. But I tell you something, I think a lot is going to be contingent on where Henderson chooses to play next season. Because whilst he is essentially a Man United player, I still think, sadly, reputation is the kind of subtext that you were building there, is such a driver.
Yeah.
And maybe 2 or 3 seasons ago, you could easily make the case, without any hyperbole, that De Gea was the best, or certainly maybe in the top 2 goalkeepers in the world, depending on one's preference. For whatever reason, I don't know if his headspace is directly correct. I don't know if he's just missing the sort of sense of challenge with Man United consistently being in contention for titles and European Cups and what have you. I don't know, whatever it is, there's something that's not quite right with De Gea. So for me right now, he isn't even Manchester United's number one, and that should go to Henderson. But of course, then that entails an elevated aspect of pressure. How will Henderson react if he chooses that path? But my point, coming back to reputation, is I still think that De Gea is perceived by the power structure that is Man United. Let's not forget, they are paying him an astronomical amount of money per week based on his previous well-earned credentials. So I still think De Gea is Man United's number one almost by default, which means no matter how skillful you are, no matter how you are privileged in training to be playing alongside the best of the best at Man United, if Henderson goes there, it's too big a leap. I'm sure it is too big a leap for anybody to then be consistently entrusted with a crucial goalkeeping role at international level. So I think next season is really critical for Henderson. I'd rather hope that he chooses to either stay at Sheffield United for another campaign or maybe a similar deal, go to another Premier League type club. And irrespective of that, it has to be maybe a team of lesser reputation. Roll the dice that it's infinitely better to be playing first team football, to put yourself in that Gareth Southgate shop window, than essentially kicking the heels as second fiddle to De Gea. I mean, again, he may take a gamble that if De Gea starts poorly, that he'll then get the big chance, which would be a big chance. And he can't fault that. But for me, if he truly aspires to be the number one for England in the sticks, he should seek out a similar type Sheffield United deal. But that remains to be seen. Number one, though, for me, the most critical point, he is, depending on where he plies his trade, like you say, Jason, in my head, likewise, the number one for the country. Not sold on Pickford. I think he's under an awful lot of pressure. And we shall see how that young man reacts. Because sometimes, we've all experienced it, pressure can bring the best out of us. But moving swiftly on now. You know what, Jason? I love the fact there, a little minute or two ago, that you brought up a young man, terribly young man, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Now, long-term Verum Sports podcasting listeners, and incidentally, this will be available as a podcast too. Do check out the award-winning Radio Verum website. Find the podcasting tab. You can find a whole heap of our quality sporting podcasts, but there's a podcast for everybody. There's so much great music, live music, debates, all kinds of wonderful quality output that the wonderful team at Radio Verum have produced. Anyway, coming back to the podcast in question, where you made a case, a very good case, that that young man, Trent Alexander-Arnold, should be in an all-time England 11. Now, Jason, I still maintain my principal point. It hasn't deviated from that, in the sense that I still think now I would put Neville there, Gary Neville there, in that all-time England 11 slot. However, in making that case, Jason, you were very prescient, almost prophetic, in that you already observed that he had a Champions League around a medal around his neck. And of course, Liverpool inexorably went on to claim the Premier League title, meaning at a tender age, he does have that 1-2, the envy of many, many, many players. And wonderful record. I mean, 26 assists in 93 games for Liverpool, better than one every four games, six goals. That young man, we talk about culture of winners, we talk about habit of winning, well, he has that in spades. And you feel, under the tutelage of Klopp, he's only going to get better. And that is a bona fide world-class young man who, I don't know, like I say, can't yet get him into my all-time England 11. But I suspect when it's all said and done, that that indeed will be more than fair. Tell you what I think is very fair right now, though, Jason. In a world 11, he's going to be knocking on that door at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other right-back in the world that really comes close to him. For what he does, record assists for a defender already in kind of back-to-back seasons as well. He is absolutely fantastic. The only one that really comes close to him, and my goodness, we have to thank England set up for this, is Aaron Wan-Bissaka. He is a very different kind of right-back. He is a more defensive one. He doesn't create as much. So I think there is a positive problem for England. It offers versatility. But across the back line, there's a lot of talent. I think Trent Alexander-Arnold is going to be one of the best players all time. We've also got a very good left-sided player now. Now, I remember 2018 World Cup, we had Danny Rose, who didn't inspire a lot. You know, he was a good defensive asset. He did a job. But Chilwell is kind of the new mould of left-back. He bombs on. He's really creative. And again, he's in one of the top teams at Leicester. And I like Harry Maguire. I think one of the big questions is who is going to partner him at this upcoming tournament. Tyrone Mings has been experimented with. For me, I don't think Mings really is good enough. I think the fact that he wasn't good enough for Bournemouth, and we saw what happened with their paltry defence. I would like to throw in another Sheffield United player, left-footed as well, which exactly fits the kind of passing style. Jack O'Connell. I think he's somebody that's been overlooked in terms of the England setup once again, but he fits the mould perfectly. He is a great passer. He's part of the overlapping centre-back, so he's a really modern kind of centre-back as well. He is damn good, and hopefully, again, kind of like Dean Henderson, hopefully next season he can show Southgate, this is my time.
As always, Jason, I value your insights there. I think there's lots of options, but still the concern for me is whilst we're adding all these new players to the mix, it reaffirms what we were saying with regards the lack of clarity now less than a year away from this important tournament in terms of who is the makeup of Southgate's team. But that being said, again, I'm going to don my pint half full attitude. And I'm going to say this, we've already touched upon Trent Alexander-Arnold. We've referenced some very strong strike power, and there's some young up-and-coming kind of Tyros at the back. The overall theme for this, Jason, I guess, is that, again, this tournament now should have been all she wrote, and we'd have been dissecting it. It's still over a year away, or just under a year away. Does that time lag mean that the likes of Trent Alexander-Arnold continue their upward trend? Maybe Kane gets back to his fitness and is really firing. Again, these young Tyros get that a little bit more experience, maybe grow into their natural game. Is this year difference really playing into the favour of the Three Lions? Or do you think that that's not going to be strong enough to compensate for the concerns we've already addressed tonight?
No, I totally think that a year, you know, even a week in football is a very long time. You can go from hero to zero or backward the other way in such a quick amount of time. I think, you know, we've discussed a lot of themes here about tactics, about decisions. And I think 1 year on, especially with this amazing, I would say maybe golden generation 2.0 of England. That is how good I feel this current crop of players are. I think a year exploring, looking at the tactics and finalising who is going to play where and possibly back up those players who are, you know, cemented 11. I think that's fantastic. You know, as I said a little bit earlier, 12 different midfielders used in the build-up to Euro 2020 before it got cancelled. It's just not good enough. And hopefully this extra year gives it time for players. You know, we're focusing on defence here, but even midfield, even in attack, you know, you said Sancho probably definitely starts. I think he should as well. I think Sterling should as well. But there's a lot of players up for debate, probably midfield and defensively. Those are such important areas of the field. So I think it can only benefit it. But do you think it's going to complicate things a bit more, Tony? Or do you agree that this time off is actually maybe a blessing in disguise for England?
I mean, it's such a compelling debate. And again, thank you for choosing this. As always, this is your show every bit as much as it is ours. I'm sure you've got your opinions on Southgate's Three Lions and their chances in next summer's European Championship. Do continue to get involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. But my concern, I can't stop but come back to it, I'm afraid, is that I love all that positivity. I just get the sense that there is an awful lot of uptrend in the England way. And I think that Southgate has already cultivated that. All great. But I look at all great teams in multiple sports. A year away from the tournament, it's not necessarily right or proper that you want to be like fixed and rigid in your thought processes. But you kind of embedded a team that you know the core there, the spine, again, to use that phrase in the football lexicon, is there. And I just think it's a big ask to kind of solve so many of these conundrums. Also, Jason, I think we've referenced, haven't we, that maybe the recent successes in the last World Cup was a reflection of a total lack of expectation. Now, England, with their resources and, you know, the football is the beautiful game. It's the most popular sport. It's the most participated sport. The FA is blessed with many, many millions of pounds, way more than other nations. They should be going in with expectations. They, frankly, have mega underperformed for 50 plus years. And I would say that's another argument for another day. I think it's a tragedy. I really do. But my point's simple. There is now a danger of kind of these emblems, as you just said there, Golden Generation, hashtag Mark II, rebooted, the force of the future. I mean, look, it's exciting. We in the media need to use these things because it's kind of our role in the world. But I just think this adds a certain flavor, which doesn't actually work in England's favor, never has done. And so that's a concern for me. But again, coming back to my positive attitude, there is some exciting talent here. Should things go in the right direction, I can imagine England could well make a case to be there or thereabouts. I'm very confident, but I'm kind of balancing that. But Jason, one thing that was raised early in the piece with some wonderful social media engagements, all of England's group matches are at Wembley. Great stuff. The semi-final and the final indeed are at Wembley. Obviously, the only time England won the World Cup was back in 66 and all that, of course, on home turf. Those of a slightly younger generation, but maybe with reasonably strong memories, I'm sure can recall football's coming home, 96. And again, where England narrowly fell out to those Germans on semi-final form on pens. But my point is, I wonder, and it was a great point raised, and I love your take on it now, home aspect in what is a road trip of a tournament taking place across 51 matches, 12 cities it's taken in, but that England group games all at Wembley, semi-final set at Wembley, final itself set at Wembley. Home field advantage, is it our time?
It's framed beautifully, isn't it? It's almost set in the stars, you know. You're talking a little bit about the force there. It did feel like something magic is about to happen. And I think, you know, reiterating my point there, I think the time aspect will help with the problems of choosing teams, tactics, etc. But you've also highlighted a point there as well that historically we have built up Golden Generation 1, you know, Gerrard, Lampard, Scholes, they couldn't play together. And I think sometimes this was an added irritation of the media, but also I think as well, club rivalries added a lot of problems as well. And I think that's dissipated a little bit. So I think that's one aspect we don't have to worry about. I think a lot of players have kind of put that to a side, and inter-club rivalries are still as fresh as ever, but they're not as maybe as partisan for England, which I think was damaging in the past. But the threat of over expectations, over pressure, especially for these young heads, Dean Henderson, who, you know, hasn't made it into the squad yet, Pope, who's hardly capped at all, I think there is a real threat there. I think you've really highlighted something. And the fact that it's in front of a home audience as well adds to the worry, to the mix. You know, a lot of these players will probably come out and think, oh God, I haven't done it in front of my home crowd. So yeah, I couldn't agree with you more there. There's a positive mix of playing in front of your home crowd, but also the reality of the situation is as well that, oh God, we're playing in front of our home crowd. We better do something. And maybe it might cause Southgate once again, because he hasn't won something yet, to overthink, over worry and over tactical. So that's a really hard one to call. Maybe Graham would be a better one to kind of give a psychological analysis on it. But I think it's going to be mixed. I don't think it's 100% positive at all.
No, absolutely. And again, I'd love your views on this. And now you've got them. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. And what's fascinating, Jason, is that obviously this tournament yet hasn't taken its full shape. There is still qualification up for grabs. Your Republic of Ireland are still contenders. So Scotland and also Northern Ireland. so still lots of football before we even get to the big event next summer. But my point to this or question really is, are we maybe just approaching this from the wrong angle? Even given a year, either that's going to be super positive or it won't be. Time itself will tell. Is it irrelevant because are England already playing too much catch-up? My question, I guess, is who do you make as favourites? I guess Portugal, obviously Ronaldo, we've much eulogised about that young or ageing man now, but still a world talent. Spain, of course, have won it Euro-wise twice in the last three tournaments. Or could it be World Cup champions France? Or I wonder, are we in for a shock? A la 92 in this tournament where Denmark, who didn't even qualify for that tournament, actually got through by default and then went on to win the whole thing in Sweden. So, Jason, is it who do you make favourites for this? And is this, therefore, moot whether England's next year is going to see them glide and improve, etc., etc.?
For me, I think the absolute favourites have to be France. I think they, too, are a team that are going through a golden generation. You know, since the 98 World Cup, this has been amazing, littered with talent. And they just keep producing them as well, kind of knocking on the door of the starters of Umtiti and Varane. You've got people like Upamecano in the background. You've got people like Moussa Dembele that can't make it into the team, whereas Griezmann is there. Karim Benzema, I know obviously there were kind of things going on there, but he's somebody else that is world class that isn't in that side. France blew me away at the last World Cup. They absolutely destroyed Croatia in the final, and one of the best World Cup finals as well ever. They're not a team who have fear in them before. They've got young Mbappe there, who was a player with confidence before going into that tournament. And my goodness, will he be confident going into Euro 2021? So I think they're the ones to watch out for. In terms of other teams, Spain are always a good favourite because they play really nice football, but I don't think that they've got that generation that they did in 08, 12, 2010 kind of region. And the Germans are always there or thereabouts because of their really strong tactics philosophy. And I'd probably say Belgium as well. But what I would say is I'd say England, if they can get the recipe right, are probably in that top five there. I would say on their day, they could beat Belgium, Germany, Spain, as they have done already. It's France, whether they can beat them. On their day, a lot of these players are the best in the world. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Sterling, in their positions. It's just whether they can bring that onto the field that day. So I think England, actually, I don't think it's a moot point at all, Tony. I think this is probably one of the best chances that England have had for a long, long while. I'm very much Mr. Glass half full, maybe even three quarters full on this one. I don't know if you agree, though. Do you think England are there or thereabouts, or is there still a bit too much to do? Maybe it's the next tournament that we should be looking at.
I'm sick of this attitude of next tournament thinking, and they need to seize the now. They have the chance. They truly do. There's so much talent bubbling away, but there are too many question marks at this moment in time. Again, I come back to that emblem of all winning teams, consistent winning teams. They just have a sense and a handle of who their team is. And also, whilst we've identified a handful of players who are bona fide world class, my point's really simple. Again, coming back to this attitude of analysing sports, as I love to do across all sports, the key question sometimes that comes across very clearly is a question when you're looking at your mate in the dressing room. Would I rather have you or your opposite number? And I just don't think at the moment England have enough at that true world-class level to truly seal the deal. However, I think there is cause for optimism. We've made it. I'm always going to default to at least a half pint. Can't quite make it three quarters at this time. So many great talents, though, to come. Watch out for Belgium. I think they are going through a true golden-esque generation for them, and they need to seize the day. Portugal, of course, inspired by the great man Ronaldo, defending champions. Rule them out at your peril. And so many of the great names. Plus, the nature of the European Championship is, again, there are these curveballs. Remember, of course, Greece won it back in 2004. Who would have thought that, really? As I've already mentioned, Denmark didn't even qualify originally. Came through, as it were, literally through the back door to claim the deal with the great Dane, Schmeichel in goal, the Laudrup brothers getting it done. Such a fascinating historical tournament, and it's less than a year away. No, you've got your views. Are the three lines finally going to end 50 years of hurt? Or is it going to be another inglorious failure? Love to hear from you. Do keep involved. Again, your views on Southgate. Is he the man? Love his waistcoat? Or is that just all a little bit affectatious and maybe missing the point? Keep involved with us. Engage. Tweet at Berham Sport. And of course, remember, we're going to be back next week with another sporting debate, and that's always going to be your choosing. So make sure you engage with us. Tweet at Berham Sport. But for tonight, I want to say a massive thank you to the machine, Jason McKenna for his phenomenal input. I want to say a big thank you to you and again for all your involvement. Make sure you check this out because it will be available in podcasting too. And make sure you're back with us on 92.6 FM next Saturday, 6 till 7, and every Saturday thereafter for some more fabulous sporting debates.